Center for Great Plains Studies Paul Olson Seminar for February. I'm Jim Stubendick, and I serve as the director of the center. George Engelman is a professor in the Department of Geography and Geology with the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Professor Engelman became interested in fossils at a very young age. He grew up in Chicago and was a frequent visitor to the Field Museum. And at the age of 12, he joined a field party of the American Museum of Natural History, led by Malcolm McKenna, to collect fossil mammals. And then later in graduate school, he studied fossil mammals under Professor McKenna. George earned his BS in Illinois, his master's and PhD at Columbia University, and his dissertation had as much to do with the philosophy of science and how evolutionary relationships are discovered as it did with fossil mammals. Professor Engelman's research recently has been on Jurassic mammals that lived with the dinosaurs, as well as on the dinosaurs themselves. He currently has a field project at Dinosaur National Monument in Utah. Well, this seminar is part of a semester-long recognition of Charles Darwin and his pioneering work in the development of the theory of evolution. And the title of Professor Engelman's presentation today is The Fossil Record and the Fact of Evolution. George?
Before I start here, I just wanted to say that this talk is actually much larger than it will be. By that I mean that the things that I'm going to talk about today touch on philosophy, history, geology, paleontology, evolutionary biology, a lot of different things. And these are all things, well, it's a vast topic, and they could all be discussed ad infinitum. So I've really kind of hit the high points here. I've tried to work out a point, if you will, and the title sort of sums up that point. And all of these things are part of it. The fact of evolution, starting off. Obviously, I titled this to make a point or to catch one's attention here. When we say the fact of evolution, is that right? After all, we always hear that evolution is a theory. And in fact, from the creationists, we frequently hear evolution is just a theory. In fact, the idea of theory that most people have is that it's a sort of an ephemeral, fragile thing, and it doesn't really have much substance or robustness. Whereas facts, on the other hand, are raw, hard stuff of truth and are immovable. But I suggest that maybe it's not quite such a black and white world, and maybe theories often are quite robust, and facts can be fragile as well. Facts are really, even direct observations that we take as facts are in some ways hypothetical, because an observation that we make depends a lot on the observer's expectations, previous experience, a lot of things that go into the observation. And then, of course, once that's communicated to somebody else, other hypothetical elements enter in. And when we get to events that are remote in space and time, such as things that occurred, well, if we want to take the simplest case, just before our lifetime, before we have any possibility of any direct experience, we rely on reports of others, on material evidence, on things that will allow us to make inferences about what happened in the past. So really, like a scientific hypothesis, statements about the past, and this goes equally well for statements about distant locations, who has ever been to the sun, for example, really rely on other hypotheses, other theories, if you like. And they have to remain open to criticism and testing, just like scientific hypotheses. So the distinction between fact and theory perhaps is not so firm as we might like to think. Also, like scientific hypotheses, historical inferences can never really be absolutely proven. But our confidence in these kinds of statements does increase, does improve, as they become more corroborated, as more of our observations, more of our tests of them seem to stand up. is in my hand here. So let's go on and talk about this, about evolution. Why am I talking about the fact of evolution? Well, what exactly does evolution include? A lot of people use this term in many different ways. And again, you'll see that I keep referring to creationists, and of course that's one of the focal points here is that how evolution has been represented by, and I'll just use the term creationist, although to try to divvy that up into participants is a complex sort of thing that we don't need to get into right now. But creationists commonly include in evolution things like the origin of the earth, the origin of life. In fact, the origin of the universe, the Big Bang, often gets lumped in under the umbrella of evolution. This is really, I would say, a non-conventional use of the term evolution, but I'm sure you may have encountered it. Even a more conventional use of the term evolution still includes more than one thing, and commonly includes at least two things. It often refers to both the process by which descent with modification, and that's, by the way, the term that Darwin used, descent with modification, the process by which this occurs. But the term evolution also is used to refer to the history of that descent with modification as well, the result of that process. And it's that latter that a lot of people have referred to as, well, we'll come to that, as the fact of evolution. Let's look first at the theory. And I didn't necessarily start out to make this about Darwin, but you really have to include Darwin at some level, and it's quite appropriate given the time, the anniversary and everything. This is Darwin just about at the time The Origin of Species, On the Origin of Species was published. Hereafter in the talk you'll see I just refer to it as The Origin, and that's simply for the sake of brevity, but that's common way that biologists often refer to The Origin of Species as The Origin. Anyway, in The Origin of Species, what Darwin did was he conceived of this idea of natural selection, and he set about to document all of the different elements that contribute to it, and he documented them six ways to Sunday. He found, if you look at the On the Origin of Species, the first chapter is about selection in domestication, human selection, not natural selection. He took up pigeon fancying and various other undertakings like that simply to learn how these things work. So he spent a lot of time trying to figure out how things work, gathering evidence, and he put a lot of that into On the Origin of Species. And we'll talk, the main, in fact, two of the chapters that he deals with here are concerned with two main components of natural selection. One is variation within species, and the other is the competition for resources, which he referred to as the struggle for existence. And those are really essential components, because if you accept these premises that there is variation, natural variation, heritable variation, we can get a lot more specific if we want to, we're not going to go there for the sake of brevity, and if you accept that organisms compete for resources, the consequence of that is pretty much inescapably natural selection. The population will be transformed according to the success of those variants that are better at utilizing the resources. The consequence of natural selection, the operation of this process, provides descent with modification then. And that is what Darwin really set out to demonstrate, was that there was a mechanism, a naturalistic process, that could produce this change in organisms. I'll leave that as it is for now. That consequence provides a history of descent. In other words, if natural selection has operated throughout history, then we would expect that there would be this descent with modification, which will produce a history of dissent. And that history of transformation and diversification is something that had already been inferred from observations of the natural world before Darwin was even born. And it was that observation of a history of dissent that called for a mechanism to explain it. The history of dissent is a singular statement of events, specific events, not that it could have happened this way, but it did happen this way. And that is a fact, okay, in the sense that we'll use it here, a singular observation or a singular statement inferred from evidence. And that's what people often refer to as the fact of evolution, this history, actual history of dissent. Now, let's take a look at that history of dissent and where it comes from. That meaning of the term evolution actually, as I said, goes back well before Darwin. Several people had espoused the notion and gathered evidence for it. We'll try to list several of them. I just mentioned two here that are particularly well known. One, because of the connection to Darwin. Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was one of the early proponents of evolution as an explanation of organic diversity. Here, using the term evolution to mean a history of descent with modification. He didn't have a mechanism for it. Another well-known name was the French naturalist Lamarck, active in the late 18th century, before Darwin's time. Lamarck also saw the history of descent with modification as an explanation for how you could get the patterns of diversity that we see in nature. Lamarck also had difficulty with a mechanism. He's usually today associated with the, phrase the inheritance of acquired characteristics. That is, that organisms change their abilities and their capabilities throughout their life, and that they pass those on to their offspring. As we understand it today, many of the things that are acquired in the lifetime of organism are not inherited, but rather the capacity to make those changes is inherited from one generation to the next. But in any case, Lamarck had the same kinds of mechanism difficulties that Erasmus Darwin and others had at the time. What was the evidence that this recognition, this fact of evolution, this history of descent, was based on? Well, again, it was largely drawn from living organisms, because mostly that's what people had seen. And actually, they didn't even have a very good sample of living organisms of the world. Mostly, we're talking about the living organisms of Europe, which is a relatively small sample if you've ever been to the tropics. Some of the observations I mention here, I list here, the commonality of features among diverse organisms, that is, organisms that have a variety of different forms, nevertheless share many features in common. And that actually has been the basis, or had been the basis, even in Darwin's time, for classification as devised by Linnaeus and others for quite a long time before that. Another observation is the structural similarities, what we now call homologies, even between very differently adapted organisms in complex organs. So even though we may have organs that have very different function, those organs may have a lot of similarities as a result of their, we'll talk about what that's the result of. But that's some of the evidence here. And then another bit of evidence that was used, Darwin had a whole chapter about this on the origin of species, is the retention of features that preserve little of the presumed original function as seen in other organisms. So let's look at a couple of examples of these things. Here's the commonality of features. Here's an example of that, and an example of how it's used in classification. You could use just about any classified organism to do this. I'm a vertebrate specialist, so I tend toward the vertebrates. And just for the sake of keeping it close to home, I've decided to look at, we'll see what we're looking at here. What do vertebrates have in common? Well, all vertebrates have in common skeletal elements made out of bone. It turns out it's not actually the internal skeleton, because if you go back, the internal skeleton is mainly cartilaginous, things like sharks and so forth. It turns out that the most fundamental bone is on the outside. Our teeth are probably the most fundamental bony elements that we share with all other vertebrates. Nevertheless, bony skeletal elements is a vertebrate characteristic. Nothing else has it. And a spine that consists of vertebrae. And within the vertebrates, all tetrapods. This is all of the things that walk around on four legs. It includes amphibians and reptiles, okay, and mammals and birds, which, as it turns out, really tetrapod is a much better term for all of those things. All tetrapods have walking limbs and feet with toes. Doesn't sound like much. There are other similarities, but that'll do for our purposes. And within the tetrapods, we find that there is a smaller subset, the amniotes. And all the amniotes develop an amniotic sac that supports the developing embryo, either in the egg or in the womb, depending on how that reproductive process is followed out. But they all have that same characteristic in their reproduction. And within the amniotes, all mammals have hair and associated skin glands. We can sweat. We can be oily. And the females can produce milk through mammary glands, which are a variant on these things. So that's another shared characteristic, a common feature. And within the mammals, all the primates have certain common characteristics of the teeth and the skull, which again, unless you're into anatomy, we don't need to go into here, but you can consistently recognize primates from those elements and other things as well. And within the primates, all the apes have greatly reduced the tail and have further specializations of the teeth and other things like that, and that includes us. So this commonality of features shows up again and again and again in the diversity of life. Here's another way of representing it. This is a diagram that has grouped things according to those nested hierarchies of characteristics, and you don't really need to... here we go. For instance, down here are the chordates. We're in there somewhere, along with the fish and the reptiles and the amphibians and everything else, and all these things connect up because they all have common characteristics. Well, at a slightly higher level, we share characteristics with, we've got probably echinoderms here, because they're our closest, here are the echinoderms, they're our closest relatives, and outside that you've got fungi and so on. This is everything, basically. Out here we have bacteria. So, as I say, this is what we use to classify organisms these days. And it produces a nice tree-like diagram like this, which, by the way, could be read as a map of the history of descent. Okay, the other kind of evidence, again, Darwin has a chapter in The Origin of Species on this, is what we call homologous features, homologies. Homologous structures are features that, because of their common ancestry, again, this is our inference, have similar characteristics, even though they may be put to very different uses. And here we have all modern organisms, but we've got a frog. These are all four limbs. So we have a frog here, a lizard, and a bird, a human, a cow, a whale, and a bat. And you notice that they all have in common one upper arm bone, one large upper arm bone, a humerus, these two lower arm bones, radius and ulna, a bunch of bones in the wrist, and most of these things, except for the bird, have five fingers extending from there. Even though we have a flipper for a whale, a wing for a bat, a different kind of wing for a bird, and grasping and walking appendages, human for grasping, lizards and frogs for walking. Lots of different uses, but common structural characteristics. And then the rudimentary structures, this is Darwin's term again, features that are retained from an ancestral condition where they may have had a different use, and even though they don't have that use any longer, they still retain many of the similar characteristics. And one example that is often referred to is the presence of in whales, which as completely aquatic organisms use flippers. They don't walk around on land. They don't really have any posterior appendages remaining, but they still have inside the pelvis and the femur, the upper bone of the hind leg. The reason those things are still preserved there or are still present there is because there are muscle attachments, but they are no longer walking appendages by any means, and yet they still have those same kinds of characteristics. So, what's the inference here? This historical inference we're talking about. Taking that evidence and other things like biogeography, the distribution of plants and animals on the planet, and the fossil record, which we haven't gotten into yet, but we will, saving it for later. Ever since the demise of spontaneous generation, the concept of spontaneous generation, which, by the way, was only finally eliminated as a possibility a short time before Darwin, a short time before evolution as an explanation for biological diversity came about, and perhaps that's not a coincidence, because spontaneous generation allowed all kinds of things to sprout spontaneously out of inorganic material. But once it was demonstrated that that wasn't happening, the only way anybody knew that organisms could be made was by reproduction of other organisms. The other thing that goes along with that is that reproduction of organisms usually, almost always, produces organisms with similar characteristics. Or if we turn that around, we can say that organisms with similar characteristics probably have similar inheritance, come from ancestors with similar characteristics. And really, that's the basis for this inference that when we see common characteristics in the diversity of life, it probably is an indication of common inheritance. Okay? The only natural explanation available to us is that the patterns that are described by the homologies and the commonality of features and the rudimentary characters are the result of this descent from earlier organisms with modification to produce the differences that we see. Okay? But the question is, how could that happen? So right around 1800, this is where we are. We have this inference that such a history exists for life, but we really don't have a good explanation for how it could have happened. And so most biologists didn't accept this inference of history. They decided it was coincidence or that there were other reasons for it. And in fact, most of them basically accepted creation as an explanation for organic diversity. That's the way it had been created. So, along comes Darwin. What did Darwin do? What was his contribution? It's especially popular nowadays in some circles to kind of play down Darwin's contribution, suggest he really didn't do anything. Some argue that all Darwin did was recognize a truism. However, what I suggest that Darwin did, and I'm not alone in this, is that he really accomplished two things. The first thing is he provided a naturalistic mechanism, natural selection, by which this transformation could be accomplished. Okay? So we have all this information that suggests a history of descent, an evolutionary history, but no way to make it happen. And the main impediment, a good analogy here, I'm kind of getting off the track here, but the same thing could be seen in the history of plate tectonics, which is now the dominant or the unifying theory in geology, the history of the planet. In the 1920s, Alfred Wegener proposed an idea that came to be known as continental drift. It was based on characteristics, evidence that seemed to indicate that the continents fit together, that they had at one time been united and that had more recently separated, moved apart. But the geologists of the time, Wegener himself wasn't a geologist, the geologists of the time, and for decades afterwards, insisted that this couldn't happen because there was no possible mechanism to make it so. And it wasn't until the 1960s when new evidence allowed geologists to come up with a mechanism, seafloor spreading, later known as plate tectonics, that it all worked out. And once the mechanism was in place, in a very short period of time, virtually all geologists recognized that plate tectonics was the explanation for all these features in Earth history. Well, the very same sort of thing happened with evolution. Darwin provided a mechanism. The other thing he did was he gathered massive amounts of evidence. And On the Origin of Species is that initial documentation. So that a very short time after the publication of The Origin, most biologists accepted evolution as a fact, the history of evolution, and were willing to accept natural selection as a mechanism because it seemed to work. A very quick turnaround for a major theory with that explains a lot of details of our observations. So that's really Darwin's major contribution is those things. Well, what's happened to evolution since Darwin? Some people suggest that, again, the creationists usually suggest that they try to identify evolution with Darwin as if nothing has happened since then. And you may have heard about a letter to the New York Times recently where somebody said, really, we got to get rid of Darwinism so that we can concentrate on evolution. But I'm not persuaded by that argument because I think that we haven't been distracted by Darwin at all. Evolution as a scientific field of study or as a research program really has been very effective since Darwin. In the 150 years since the publication of The Origin, there have been numerous revisions and additions and refinements to those initial concepts. You'll get a lot of argument among evolutionary biologists about whether natural selection alone is sufficient to account for the history of evolution that we see. There are some who claim that it absolutely is not, others that would argue just as strongly that it is, that there's enough time available to do that. But not, almost all of them, even those that think natural selection is sufficient, really don't have a big problem with the possibility of other mechanisms that might act in addition to or independently of selection. And a number of such have been proposed, some of them rejected, some of them accepted over the years. So there's actually a lot more going on here than just what Darwin contributed. The other thing that's happened in that 150 years is that we've learned a lot more about how things work. For instance, Darwin had absolutely no good understanding of the mechanism of inheritance. He had really the same problem that Lamarck did. And even though Gregor Mendel was a contemporary of Darwin and sort of figured out some of the basics of genetics, Darwin didn't know about that. And it wasn't until decades later that most of biology caught on to it as well. But the mechanism, the basic mechanism of inheritance, we have a pretty good understanding of now, down to the molecular level. And in fact, at the present time, that is so well researched that we're beginning to make progress with the connection between the mechanism of inheritance and the mechanism of development that actually turns that inheritance into living organisms. All of that's new since Darwin, some of it quite new. And the other thing, of course, is that some aspects of Darwin's work have been increasingly better corroborated by new evidence. And again, one of the striking examples of this is the fossil record, as we'll see a little bit later. But I want to step away from evolution for a minute and look at the interaction between evolution and religion, because really that bears on some of the things that I want to talk about here as well. Often the creationists and some scientists represent evolution as in direct conflict with religious belief. That is, if you accept evolution as a scientific hypothesis, you're rejecting a belief in God. Likewise, there are some scientists who say if you accept science as a means of explaining things, you must reject God. Richard Dawkins is one, notably, takes that stance. But really, that's not the majority opinion among scientists or philosophers, for that matter. And we'll come back and talk about that a little bit later. So what really is the truth about this relationship between religion and science, specifically evolution? Well, immediately following the publication of The Origin, there was a pretty strong reaction from religious people and spokespeople for religious organizations, and it was pretty uniformly negative against evolution. Part of the reason was because of the implications for the truth of Scripture. The stories related in the Bible seemed not to agree with the story of evolution implied by acceptance of evolution, the fact, and evolution, the consequence of evolution, the theory. But probably a bigger reason had to do with the perceived demotion of humanity from a divine and special place on the earth. And perhaps that's yet to be resolved for some. But in the 150 years since the origin, a lot has happened in this area, and for the most part, the major religions and religious groups have come to terms with evolution and really no longer find it to be in conflict with their beliefs. And there are a number of reasons for that, but I've suggested that advances in science and in other scholarly endeavors, for instance, like Bible scholarship and things like that, have allowed new perspectives on the Bible that don't require you to reject the Bible as divine revelation in order to not require you to interpret every story in the Bible as exact historical truth. And that really is where the conflict that remains comes from, as we'll see in a moment. Most religions in the world regard science as part of an entirely separate area of human experience, human endeavor. Steve Gould and I think E.O. Wilson are enamored of the term magisteria, that science is one magisterium and religion is another. In other words, they're entirely different ways of knowing the world, and they don't really have anything to say about each other. What do scientists think about this? From the point of view of religion, as I say, it appears most religions are okay with evolution and science. Are most scientists okay with religion? Well, scientists as a group are a pretty agnostic, atheistic bunch compared to the rest of the world. But that doesn't mean that most of them are antagonistic to religion. In fact, except for those who argue that science requires the rejection of a belief in a creator, I find that most scientists are consider that science is mute on the point of the existence or non-existence of a creator. That is, that science really can't answer that question. And interestingly enough, there are a number of scientists, including evolutionary biologists, who are themselves believers. Among vertebrate paleontologists, for instance, I know some who are quite vocal about it. And a particular example here that I pulled up is an interesting one. Theodosius Dobzhansky, who died in 1975, was one of the foremost evolutionary biologists of his generation and one of the leaders in incorporating experimental evolutionary genetics into the whole scheme of evolutionary theory. And yet, he wrote an essay in 1973 titled, "Nothing in Biology Makes Sense Except in the Light of Evolution." And this is often quoted because it's one of the briefest, most succinct statements of why evolutionary theory is important, because it makes sense of so much of biology. And yet, what was this essay about? The essay was about the it was an attempt to reconcile religious belief in a creator with evolutionary biology, because that was what Dobzhansky believed. Another interesting point here that I might throw in as well, when he talks about the light of evolution, he's actually deliberately referring to a quote from a paleontologist, a vertebrate paleontologist, and an evolutionist, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who was a Jesuit priest. So this seems to suggest to me that there isn't any automatic animosity between religion and evolution. The problem comes about with a fundamentalist approach to interpreting the Bible. That is, that every word of the Bible is literally true. That is, that the Bible presents a true history of the world. Because if that is required, then the history that evolution implies and the history that we observe from and we infer from the evidence clearly does not coincide with that biblical history. And it's this disagreement of histories that's really the root cause of the clash with evolution. So, a little bit about creationism. Again, this is an umbrella term as well, and I'm well aware of that. But the groups and the individuals that strongly oppose evolution tend to fall under that umbrella. The underlying cause of the disagreement between creationism and evolution really hasn't changed since the origin of species. And so this conflict hasn't gone away. But over time, the strategies that the creationists have employed to try to combat the spread of evolution, if you like, as an idea through society has changed quite a bit. It's evolved, if you will. Early in the 20th century, and this is the time of the Scopes trial that everybody's probably heard of that was fictionalized in Inherit the Wind, the direct challenge to the teaching of evolution in schools was pretty workable. That is, to just say that teaching evolution is anti-religion, and therefore it should be suppressed. And that worked rather well, actually. Even when it didn't succeed outright, it had the effect of intimidating, so that for many decades, evolution wasn't really taught in public schools. All that changed when Sputnik went into orbit and the government decided we needed a better science education. And along with that, evolution got back into the textbooks and got back into the classroom. And of course, it was at that time that creationists had a response, and the response was to try to get into the classroom as science. And so the concept of creation science came along, which was really an attempt to use material evidence, to use science, to prove the truth of the biblical creation stories. Again, we still have this conflict between the history of the fact of evolution and the history in the Bible, but the suggestion was that there's a scientific basis for that biblical history. Well, that didn't work too well. The courts recognized that this creation science was really fundamentally a religious teaching, and that the only way you could claim that it had scientific proof was to start out with the conclusion that you attempted to prove. So that in the 1970s pretty much was eliminated. And the latest go-around, the latest strategy, is something that goes by the name of intelligent design. And intelligent design seeks to undermine evolutionary theory by attacking these naturalistic mechanisms as being insufficient to explain biological diversity, or in other words, to accomplish the fact of evolution. It doesn't really touch the history of descent, the fact of evolution, as we'll see in a moment. And ironically, it seems so to me anyway, intelligent design, or idea as it's often known, doesn't even address that. It's really a reworking of an old argument, an argument that actually predates evolutionary theory, that was perhaps most popularly or most famously stated by William Paley, the Reverend William Paley. And that's an attempt to look at the material world and argue from that a proof of the existence of God. Okay? This is sometimes referred to as Paley's watch. Not going to go into that now. We can talk about it later if you'd like to. Okay. Now, the thing that's the problem with that, though, this ignoring of the history of descent, is that apparently the ID strategy is assuming that if you undermine the theory of evolution, the mechanism, the fact of evolution will tumble along with it. And you might think that if you go back and you look at Darwin's time and you find that people were unwilling to accept a history of descent until they had a viable mechanism in natural selection. But this is a different time. The evidence that people were working with at that time didn't as strongly support that historical inference as the evidence that we have available to us today. That historical inference, that fact of evolution, is much better supported today. And even if a particular mechanism for evolution ends up being undercut, and actually ID doesn't really do that very well either, but that's another whole other discussion. But even if it were to do that, this history of descent has independently developed a very strong evidence base that supports this inference. And one of the principal sources of that evidence is the fossil record, the closest thing we have to being able to look back in time. So, what do fossils tell us about evolution? Well, actually, the information from fossils tells us a lot of things in a lot of different ways. And we'll look first here at what fossils tell us about geologic time. One of the common misunderstandings concerning the fossil record, you often hear that geologists use fossils to tell time in the rocks. And certainly this is true. And then if you say, well, these fossils are different ages and that tells us that there is a history of descent, it sure sounds circular, like circular reasoning, like you're using to tell, this fossil is this age because this fossil is this age. But in fact, that's not the way this information came about. The relative sequence of fossils in time, the age of fossils, isn't based on the fossils initially and isn't fundamentally the result of the fossils themselves, but is based on a principle called superposition. And it's described here. Let me just skip ahead to another slide, which illustrates it a little bit better. When we have sedimentary rocks, it was realized back in the 1700s, actually back in the 1600s, that they're the result of a process. And if they're the result of a process, then there is a sequence. There is an order in time during which they formed. That is, they didn't all form simultaneously, but rather these layers, and this is a kind of a little cartoon representation of mountains here with tilted rocks overlying the rocks of the mountain and then other layered rocks overlying these tilted rocks below. It's pretty straightforward once you recognize that these layers were the result of a process of accumulation, that this one has to be older than this one, and so on, giving you the relative age sequence of all of those things. Now, if those rocks contain fossils, as they do, then you have the relative age sequence of the fossils as well. And around 1800, again, before really widespread acceptance of evolution, geologists were running around finding that the sequence of fossils, distinctive fossils that they observed in the rocks, was repeated again and again and again. In fact, they found that as you look at the rocks at increasingly greater number of areas, you never find a violation of this sequence of fossils. And it strongly reinforces the observation that fossils have a distinct sequence in time, a history. Okay? That's the basis for using the fossils to tell time. Once we've established it with superposition, then you can go back and use the fossils themselves to infer age in the rocks. Let's go back here. So the point is that this sequence of fossils really is developed independently of evolution and long before Darwin. This is the result of using those fossils to establish the age. At the time that Darwin published The Origin, the fossil record was only poorly known. And in fact, his chapter on fossils is titled something like, incompleteness, on the incompleteness of the fossil record. In other words, he was apologizing for how lousy the fossil record is, knowing that if you had a really great fossil record, it should correspond to the predictions of his evolutionary theory. But you have a lousy fossil record. At least they did when Darwin wrote On the Origin of Species. But even then, as it turns out, at a very coarse scale, this sequence of fossils, this history of succession, was clearly recognized well enough for geologists to make practical use of it. And in fact, they even incorporated some of that observation into the building of the time scale. This is the part of the geologic time scale, the history of the Earth, that has an abundant fossil record. We're not going to talk at any length, in fact, to any great extent, but you're all aware that now in the 20th century, we've also developed methods by which you can use the decay of radioactive isotopes to find ages in years. And by the way, that evidence also consistently supports the sequence of fossils that we have observed based on superposition for hundreds of years now. It says that in the last 500 million years or thereabouts, we have this abundant fossil record. But the fossils consistently change throughout this history, so that if we look at the Cenozoic, which means recent life, recent animals basically, we find that the fossils here are not exactly the same as things alive today, but they include some things that are still alive today and are generally pretty similar to things alive today. If you go back here to the Mesozoic, middle life, you find more and more things that are peculiar. We don't really have any representatives of them still around. And if you go back to the Paleozoic, which means ancient life, you find some very peculiar things indeed. In fact, most of the things in the fossil record here don't look a lot like things alive today. So this change, this transformation of our best evidence of life on Earth was apparent even in Darwin's time. It's just that it was a relatively weak record of it that he didn't want to rely on. But even this history isn't the history that you read in Genesis. It contradicts it. And the thing that Darwin really would have liked to have seen, and there really was virtually no good example of it in his time, was transformations in the fossil record, where you can actually show how an ancient fossil form is connected up through intermediate forms to something more recent. Some of these started coming along. And in the 150 years since the origin, we've actually stockpiled quite a few of these transformations, fossils that show a change, a transformation through history that's consistent, again, with our superpositionally controlled history of life and with the radiometric dates and all that stuff. The way in which the fossil record has developed, though, has, well, you'll see this in a little bit later example, but initially paleontologists, like other biologists, took to the idea that evolution explained the history of life, and therefore it should explain the fossil record. But they were looking for just a few lineages. They were looking to be able to trace, say, the horse back from its present form through fossil forms in a single straight line to a much earlier ancestor, which was different in form. A few simple lineages. What the rich fossil record that we have now and that we have acquired over that 150 years seems to consistently show us is that every so often we get a nice transformation, but we always get evidence that this history of diversity is much more complicated than we naively initially assumed. Just after Darwin, paleontologists were all out going looking for one fossil evolving into another. Well, the fossil record, as it turns out, is very sparse compared to the diversity, the abundance of life that we see around us at any one time. But it's plenty dense enough to give us abundant evidence of these transformations at some scale, and even more evidence of the diversification of life. Sometimes this history of life is referred to as a tree of life, but as it turns out, it's really more of a bush. In fact, it's a bushy bush. Lots and lots of branches. So let's look at some of the transformations that we have. And I've just picked a few. There's lots of them. But I've picked a few, especially because of things that we've referred to early on. When I talked about the commonality of features, and I talked about vertebrates, and within the vertebrates, the tetrapods. Well, what about tetrapods? How did tetrapods come about? All these things that have walking appendages instead of fins, like primitive vertebrates. Well, this is how they come about. And we've got a good fossil record that shows the transitional stages all the way through. When the Dover trial was going on in Pennsylvania, just about the same time, paleontologists were discovering and studying this creature here, something called Tiktaalik from Greenland, which is in just the right place in time, and more importantly, is anatomically just in the right place to be between fishy things that have a lot of characteristics in common with tetrapods, things that have walking appendages up here, but don't yet have the limbs. Well, Tiktaalik here doesn't quite have the limbs either, but unlike the fish, it's got a neck, so it could raise and turn its head and do all the kinds of things that amphibians, if you like, tetrapods, are able to do, but hasn't really come all the way. It fits neatly into this whole transition series, where we have a bunch of other fossils as well. Here's just the limbs, the forelimbs of these things, and you can see, again, a lungfish limb here, and then which has a string of fairly robust bones, and then that gets reduced down to this few where we have one here, two here, and so on. And as you follow this along, you can easily see how the common characteristics, for instance, just focus on this bone, it goes all the way across here, but you're going from a fin to a foot. And then here's, again, the whole animal, fins here, representations of the animals here. But it's a nice transition series. Here's another one that is much talked about these days. Dinosaurs to birds, or if you like, the origin of birds, the transformation to birds. Here are the birds at the very end. Except for birds and very little else here, maybe Ornithischia as a group, none of these things were known to Darwin. In fact, a lot of these things up in here, including this is Archaeopteryx, but these things here have all been found in the last 20 years. So the fossil record is immeasurably better than it was in Darwin's time, and it's much better than it was just 50 years ago. And a lot of what we find, as I said, tends to follow the pattern of filling in these intermediates or adding to the bushiness of this whole tree. So here we've got a whole bunch of dinosaurs, and one of the things, for instance, that this shows, I've picked these examples out because Archaeopteryx, which was found not too long after the origin and was much ballyhooed as a demonstration of the transformation seen in required by evolution. Archaeopteryx looks a lot like the skeleton of a dinosaur, except that it's got impressions of feathers. We hardly ever find dinosaurs with feathers, or found dinosaurs with feathers, because feathers rarely preserve. But some years ago in China, they found an area where unique conditions preserve everything. And what do we find? Well, we find birds with feathers. We find dinosaurs with feathers. Just about everything there has got feathers. So here's a dinosaur that's the skeleton is very much like a dromaeosaur. In fact, it is a dromaeosaur. Those are the things that people popularly call raptors, you know, with the big claw on the toes. But it's got feathers. Here we have another dinosaur with a little line of feathers that runs down the back and the tail here. Here we have some actual birds with feathers. All these things are from China. And there's more than that. So getting feathers apparently isn't that much of a problem. It doesn't happen when birds branch off. It happens somewhere in the dinosaurs. Lots of dinosaurs have feathers, and it just happens that one of those dinosaur groups becomes birds. And here's another transformation. Remember earlier on we had the whale up there because of the rudimentary pelvis, the little pelvis buried in his body. Well, that makes sense if the whale, which people recognize based on the common characteristics as a mammal, started out on land. Mammals are land animals, except for whales. But if whales started out on land, then we might find in the fossil record these ancestral whales that lived on land. And sure enough, eventually, they were found. A paleontologist named Phil Gingrich, working over in Pakistan, found a whole sequence of fossils, and they're some of them, at least, are represented here. This one, Pachycetus, found in Pakistan, and Ambulocetus, also from Pakistan, are things that have legs, but if you look at the skull and other characteristics, they have features that relate them clearly to whales. Here's an early primitive whale, and here's a modern baleen whale. It looks like a right whale or a bowhead or something. And up here at the top, we have not exactly a whale, but an artiodactyl. An artiodactyl is the group, or artiodactyls are the group that includes deer, sheep, goats, and so forth. And it turns out that artiodactyls have a distinctive characteristic. This is an artiodactyl heel or an ankle bone. It's a bone called the astragalus. And only in artiodactyls do you have a nice double, what's called a trochlea here. It looks like a little spool at both ends. Here's a pig, astragalus, here's Diacodexis, here's Pachycetus. Turns out the whales are artiodactyls. Looks like they're closely related to hippos. Maybe that's why, maybe they've been in the water for a long time. Anyway, and then finally, I put this in, I've mentioned it briefly before, but I especially wanted to include this because for the Great Plains, this is one of the best places to find record of these fossils. Horses have a long history in the fossil record, but almost all of it, until quite late, is here in North America. And a lot of it is in Nebraska. We don't go that far back. We don't have old enough rocks that go back into the earlier Eocene, which is what we have here. You have to go over to Wyoming to find good fossils of these guys. But everything else we get in Nebraska, all these guys. This is an early diagram of horse evolution, not too long after evolution was adopted by biologists. Around the turn of the 20th century. And by then, we had found enough fossils to actually have a pretty good transformation sequence from these early small animals called Eohippus here. Hyracotherium is a better name for it, as it turns out, up to modern horses. And you can see that not only do we have the similarity of the features of the skull, which maybe you can't judge from this diagram here, but we also have characteristics of the teeth, which you can see a little bit more clearly look very similar, except that we start out with low crown teeth here, and we go to high crown teeth here, and we have this change from 3 and 4-toed feet to 3-toed and then 1-toed feet and so forth, this transformation through time. But remember, as I said, early on, paleontologists had this naive view of what the fossil record would show, and they wanted everything to be a nice straight line, and so this is how horse evolution was represented. But what's happened as we've got more and more horses in our sample? Well, this is what's happened. This is what horse evolution looks like now. We've actually filled in more of the gaps, as it turns out. But in filling in the gaps, we've also made this whole thing much more bushy. Horses, starting out here again with Hyracotherium in the early Eocene, diversify repeatedly throughout their record. And up here in the what's called the Miocene, around 10 to 20 million years ago, we have lots of different horses living together. And we see this. If you go up to Ash Fall, you see different horses coming out of the same quarry or other places around. Some of the horses are browsers. They're eating leaves. But over here, we got a bunch of horses that are eating grass. They're grazers. And it's this branch here that eventually leads to modern horses. All modern horses come from this same line. That includes zebras, asses, the whole thing. You can still reconstruct that straight line. It goes right back down through here, but we've got a lot of additional side branches that show up with a better fossil record. Again, the creationist arguments say, look at this. They had it all wrong. They had the nice straight line before, but now it's all over the place. Well, but the straight line is still there. It's just that there's more other things. The straight line is really a function of looking back instead of looking forward. And evolution evolves forward, and forward evolution produces bushes. Okay, well, anyway, this is our wrap-up here. To conclude, the history, as I said at the beginning, always is an inference. It always has to be inferred. Whether that inference is based on trusted eyewitness accounts, as is the case with recent history. For instance, you know, when you watch the news tonight and they report on what's happening over in Iraq or something, you didn't see that. Is it a fact? Well, it's a fact as long as you trust that reporter or the people who report to him or so on down the line. But anyway, history, especially, is always an inference, and you can either have trusted eyewitnesses or you can have evidence of past events that are interpreted in the light of our current best scientific knowledge or some combination of both of those. The creationist attack on the theory of evolution, ID attacks the theory of evolution, but it turns out really that it's the history that's the problem. And that history is backed up all on its own by scientific evidence, by this chain of hypotheses that are well substantiated by their own evidence, supporting evidence. Now, this inferred history, what can we say about it? Well, we don't have it all right. We know that. The evidence is much too spotty. Our understanding is much too poor. So we've probably got the specifics wrong. It can be better resolved. It could be corrected. But at some level, this history of descent is as well established as any historical fact. I use the Civil War here as an example. It may seem frivolous, but it's not. We have as much confidence that there is a history of descent throughout geologic history as the major events of the Civil War. May be wrong about exactly who's related to who or when or this or that happened, but we could say the same thing for the Battle of Gettysburg. People are still arguing about Pickett's charge. So to deny this really is deliberately ignoring the information and the arguments that are out there. And that's my point, really. So that's all I have to say.